Welcome to The Man for Texas, Episode 1, Blood in the Sand. I'm Brandon Seal. Their general was ordering a retreat. 30-year-old Lieutenant Colonel Jose Francisco Ruiz tried to process what it was he was hearing. He repeated it back to Colonel Miguel Menchaca, his commanding officer, and the commander of the Tejano Cavalry constituting the core of the Republican Army of the North. The as-yet undefeated Republican Army of the North. The army that had made Texas perhaps the first province in the Spanish New World to rid itself of a royalist presence and to establish for itself an independent Republican government. The army whose leaders had sworn to, quote, sustain and defend this new nation hasta la última extremidad, end quote, until the last extremity. This was the army that this newcomer general, José Álvarez de Toledo, was ordering to retreat in the face of what appeared to be a numerically inferior enemy? Ruiz and Menchaca had wanted to like this Toledo. They had wanted to believe that his noble lineage and time spent in the United States would bring some kind of financial support from the sympathetic North American Republic across the Sabine. They'd wanted to believe that the self-appointed general's liberal Republican reputation from his brief time in the revolutionary Cortes de Cádiz back in Spain was well-deserved. But the truth was that Toledo had been nothing but trouble ever since he started politicking for José Bernardo Gutiérrez de Lara's job from the safety of Louisiana. Unlike Toledo, Gutiérrez de Lara was one of them, born on the Spanish North American frontier. And he'd been anointed by Father Miguel Hidalgo himself, que en paz descanse, to carry the torch of Mexican independence. Under his leadership, they'd been unstoppable. And Gutiérrez de Lara sure as hell wouldn't be retreating right now. Of course, Ruiz and Menchaca appreciated that Gutiérrez de Lara had ruffled feathers, mostly amongst the Anglo-American volunteers in the army. In the beginning, Gutiérrez de Lara had sort of waved his hands over the details of what would happen to Texas after it won its independence. Vague promises of pay and land were sufficient to win the Anglos over as allies. But after the publication of Texas's Declaration of Independence on April 6, 1813, and of Texas's Constitution on April 17th, it had become clear to the Anglo-American volunteers that Texas was, and would remain, a part of some greater Mexican republic, not an Anglo-American or even independent one. This gave many Anglo-Americans pause, and several hundred had gone back to Louisiana in recent months. And then, of course, there was the massacre of the Spanish officers. After breaking the royalist siege of Goliad in March of 1813, Gutiérrez de Lara had led the Republican army in pursuit of the fleeing royalists all the way back to San Antonio, where they routed the Spanish in open battle and captured the royalist governor and his 13 highest-ranking lieutenants. This wasn't just any Spanish governor, though. This was the governor who had ambushed and captured Father Miguel Hidalgo himself, after which the captured Hidalgo and his lieutenants had been unceremoniously sent off for trial, execution, and decapitation. It was strange, then, that some of the Anglo-Americans were so surprised by what happened to the captured royalist governor and his lackeys. He and his chief lieutenants had been tried, convicted of treason, and sentenced to exile. Which is to say, they would be exiled to the same realm where Hidalgo and his lieutenants now resided. A few miles outside of San Antonio, the royalist governor and his lieutenants were stripped, tied to trees, and their throats slit. Ruiz had been a part of this gruesome execution party. Maybe it was a loyalty test imposed on him by his new Republican comrades, since just a week prior he had still ostensibly been a Spanish royalist officer. He'd been growing disillusioned, however. Indeed, it seems like he may have been the one to have tipped off Gutiérrez de Lara to the Spanish governor's planned ambush of the Republican army on its march into San Antonio back in March, a tactical detail that allowed Gutiérrez de Lara to adjust his plan and flip the script on the Spaniards. Ruiz had come over slowly to the Republican cause. He wasn't radical by nature. But neither the indignant Anglo-Americans nor the skeptical old Republican rebels really knew that yet, and so all the more reason that Ruiz had needed to steer a middle course in the months that followed. And why, perhaps, he went along with the overthrow of the undefeated Gutiérrez de Lara. Ruiz had joined Menchaca at first in simply advocating for the inclusion of José Álvarez de Toledo on Gutiérrez de Lara's governing junta, under the condition that Álvarez de Toledo would serve underneath Gutiérrez de Lara. And yet as soon as Toledo actually arrived in San Antonio on August 1st, 1813, he and his people began insisting that Gutierrez de Lara had to go and that Toledo needed to be placed in charge. The Anglo-American volunteers and the U.S. government, whose actual support remained theoretical, always in the future, would abandon the Tejanos' cause if they didn't comply, or so Toledo's allies threatened. Gutierrez de Lara read the writing on the wall, and so did Menchaca and Ruiz. A few days later, Gutierrez de Lara was on the road to Louisiana, just as Royalist General Joaquin de Arredondo descended on San Antonio. Distrustful of old Tejanos like Menchaca and Ruiz, Toledo quickly split the army along ethnic lines, creating separate Anglo-American and Tejano units, but ripping apart the battlefield bonds that had held the fragile multi-ethnic army together. Then, Toledo announced his plans to march out of San Antonio and give battle well south of town. A horrified Menchaca, picking up on a widely circulating rumor that Toledo was, in fact, a royalist spy, called for Toledo's court-martial and accused Toledo of trying to deliver the army over to the Spanish. But then word arrived from allied Comanche scouts that the Spanish were only a few days away. Perhaps to shield the town from the horrors of battle, the Tejanos agreed at last to march out with Toledo. And even Ruiz agreed that Toledo had selected a good spot to ambush Arredondo and the Royalist army that morning of August 18, 1813. But when the first Royalist scout stumbled into range, a nervous Republican trigger finger gave away their carefully selected position, the gunfire then drawing in several hundred of the Spanish Royalist scouts' companions. The entire 1,400 or so man might of the Republican army came out of hiding and rushed into battle. The excited Republicans even captured two small cannons. As usual, it felt like, they were winning, and they were winning because they were being aggressive. And now Toledo wanted to retreat, to give up the momentum of victory. It seemed like the classic caution of someone who'd never held a battlefield command before, and certainly had never fought on the plains of South Texas, where mobility and momentum were everything. Ironically, Toledo's army was united now, united in its defiance of him. Even the Anglo-Americans were as shocked as Menchaca and Ruiz and demanded that they pursue the retreating Spanish cavalry that was now abandoning the field. And so the army defied Toledo. Perhaps Toledo relented, or both. The Republican Army of the North and its officers had a mind and spirit of its own, and that spirit didn't have restraint in its playbook. And so they charged south, the August heat above, the sugar sand below, and the oaks of the Encinal de Medina straight ahead.
Hi, I'm Art Martinez Zavada. I am a historian and attorney. I live in Von Ormy, Texas.
He's being humble. Art is an institution in Von Ormy, and he's been mayor there twice. And he's been studying Jose Francisco Ruiz now basically since 7th grade Texas history class. He's followed his trail everywhere from Mexico City to Natchitoches, Louisiana, to the municipal archives of Marin, Nuevo León. But what was it, I asked him, that initially drew him to Jose Francisco Ruiz?
When I was growing up, I would spend all my summers in Von Ormy, Texas, which is where my grandmother and grandfather lived on their farm. And I grew up, you know, hearing stories about Jose Francisco Ruiz, about his children, how they had founded the town. I didn't hear those stories in my Texas history classes.
And so recall here as well, this entire podcast season is drawn from Art Martinez de Vara's biography of Ruiz entitled Tejano Patriot. So go look it up online, Amazon, wherever you get your audiobooks. But if you listen to it, I think you'll have some of the same questions I have. And one of the big ones is, what made Ruiz the man he was? What were the roots of his ideology? What was the basis of his culture?
One of the main objectives of the book is to show how Jose Francisco Ruiz is a product of growing up on the frontier. So when you look at the historiography, which is kind of the history of the history that has been written about Ruiz, they often try to frame him as a Spaniard, as someone of high educational background. But what I found when I was researching him is that he's a product of the Texas frontier.
To be clear, though, Ruiz isn't some kind of provincial hayseed. He's recognized early as one of the brightest minds in his community.
Ruiz's father, Juan Manuel, when he arrives in San Antonio, you know, he kind of does a lot of different things. His opportunities are somewhat limited because the Canary Islanders kind of have a monopoly on the acequias, and so farming isn't really available to him. So he kind of bounces around. He's a tailor. but he's also a private tutor. And I think that's indicative of his education, and that's passed on to Ruiz himself. So at the tender age of, I think 17, he's appointed public schoolmaster. Again, his father and others had been private schoolmasters. We know from his family's background that the Ruiz family, especially in Querétaro, had deep roots in Jesuit Enlightenment thinking. It's essentially a form of humanism. Most of us are familiar with the Northern European and the Enlightenment, you know, coming to us, you know, John Locke, kind of the British tradition and whatnot. Spain had a similar movement, though it had a Catholic twist to it. For example, there was no belief in the divine right of kings. France certainly believed that, but not in Spain. And the theory there was the only divine institution is the Catholic Church. Therefore, by definition, the monarchy could not be divine. And as an extension of that, and as an emphasis on the humanistic background, is they felt that all political authority then came from the people in the form of the municipio, the collective body, the local town body represented authority. And those really much come into play later on when that system that Ruiz grew up in was completely overturned.
In 1808, Napoleon invades Spain and puts his brother on the throne. The Spanish monarchy collapses, and the towns in Spain default to self-rule under these theories of municipalism. After Father Miguel Hidalgo's grito on September 16, 1810, Spanish North America also falls apart. San Antonio first declares independence in January 1811, but that initial revolt is put down by a group of local elites, including José Francisco Ruiz. Ruiz, by this time, holds a commission in the Spanish army, and for the next year, he's one of the highest-ranking Tejanos in the Spanish army, fighting against a second attempt at independence, being led now by José Bernardo Gutiérrez de Lara. And hopefully this all sounds very familiar from season 2 of this podcast. Gutiérrez de Lara eventually gets the upper hand, drives the Spanish governor and his forces back into San Antonio, and defeats them at the Battle of Rosillo, with the secret help of José Francisco Ruiz.
That was one of those amazing research finds. Is in the Texas State Archives, I found a correspondence from Ruiz as a royalist officer writing to the Republicans' side and discussing how he's going to assist them as a royalist officer to take San Antonio and to try to do it bloodlessly.
And so what made Ruiz flip from a promising royalist to a radical revolutionary, I asked Art.
The turning point really came from an intellectual standpoint. I think it comes from the polemical writings of Gutiérrez de Lara. And Gutiérrez de Lara, he is preparing for his invasion of Texas, is drafting essays, polemics that they sneak into towns like San Antonio and Nacogdoches. And I think what Ruiz connected with was, again, his Jesuit Enlightenment upbringing or background is resonating in the political rhetoric of Gutiérrez de Lara. Certainly, you can see through his later decisions and actions in times where the future is very uncertain. He puts everything on the line. And there's times, especially at Medina, where he loses everything. And I think that's what makes Ruiz such a compelling figure, is that he is ideologically driven and puts his money where his mouth is.
So I won't retell the whole story of the Battle of Medina here. There's about 10 hours dedicated to that over in season 2 of this feed if you want it. But as you probably know, Ruiz survived the Battle of Medina. But he wouldn't see his home again for almost 10 years. Like so many other Tejano refugees, he rode east to Louisiana to figure out how to support himself and how to survive in the brand new sister republic to their east. On the next episode of The Man for Texas. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Art Martinez de Vara for joining us on this episode, and go check out his book about José Francisco Ruiz called Tejano Patriot. You should also go buy the audiobook read by me under the same name, Tejano Patriot, and available wherever you buy your audiobooks. For more information about Art and his projects, go check out artmartinezdevara.com. And for more information on my projects and past podcasts, you can go to brandonseal.com.